Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, we'll hear about the history of Illinois' first state capital, Kaskaskia, from the early booming days to a town that has just a few people remaining. Civics education in high school has gone on for years, but a new measure applies to middle schoolers. We'll find out more. With the Apollo 11 anniversary upon us, we'll hear about an engineer from Illinois who played a key role in getting men to the moon.
Most of the people who know the most about this mission feel that without Lunar Orbit Rendezvous, Apollo couldn't have succeeded. And without John Hobolt, you probably wouldn't have had Lunar Orbit Rendezvous.
The author of The Man Who Knew the Way to the Moon will join us. And we'll tell you about another example of Andrew Carnegie's philanthropy, pipe organs, and the search for those remaining here in Illinois. That and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll look back at the history of Illinois' first state capital, Kaskaskia. There's also a search underway for Carnegie pipe organs. Dozens were in Illinois. How many remain? And as we mark the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, we'll learn about an engineer from Illinois who knew the way to the moon and the role he played. That and more coming up. First today, it's been a hot week in Illinois. The state and the rest of the country could soon start seeing more days of extreme heat. Those are the days when the heat and humidity combine to make you feel like it's above 90 or 100 degrees Fahrenheit. The predictions are according to a new report by the Union of Concerned Scientists. And to talk more about what those conditions mean, our reporter Daisy Contreras spoke to senior climate scientist Rachel Licker, who co-authored the report.
Across the country, there's an startling increase in the number of extremely hot days. By mid-century, on average across the United States, the number of days with a heat index above 105 would quadruple. And in an average year, 90 million U.S. residents, that's about one-third of the U.S. population, again, assuming no growth or change, would experience an average of 30 or more days with such heat compared with less than 1 million people currently.
Let's talk about the Midwest. What do these extremely hot days mean for states like Illinois, especially for our agriculture?
Certainly for a state like Illinois that has a lot of agriculture, the results of our report are very startling because they have implications for outdoor workers. Historically, there's been about a week's worth of days with a heat index above 100 degrees Fahrenheit in the state of Illinois, and that's on average in an average year. Now, if we took no action and continued business as usual by mid-century, instead of a week's worth of days with heat index above 100 degrees Fahrenheit, the state of Illinois would be looking at about 43 days with a heat index above 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And those kinds of figures are going to jump up even more by the end of the century. And so those are conditions that are really difficult to work outdoors amidst. And so that would really have implications for the bottom line of a lot of different enterprises, work schedules, worker safety. It would really change life as we know it in many ways.
Can we go a little bit over some of the health conditions and issues that arise from extreme heat?
Extreme heat currently is one of the top weather-related causes of death in the United States. It's usually number one, number two, and those are direct reported cases of extreme heat causing a death. But also extreme heat can cause a variety of different illnesses, from heat cramp to heat stroke and, as I mentioned, death. Heat also exacerbates pre-existing health conditions, in particular respiratory disease and cardiovascular disease. So if you have outdoor workers with those kinds of conditions, extreme heat can be very dangerous in particular for them. And then there are a variety of other segments of the United States public that have unique vulnerabilities to extreme heat from a health perspective. Children, for example, are not able to cool themselves as efficiently as adults are. And so heat can be very dangerous for that part of the United States. And also elderly residents also are uniquely vulnerable.
And another thing that I found very interesting, too, is that not just the elderly or children, but people in neighborhoods with low income and who are experiencing poverty are also impacted by climate change and by heat.
Yes. Low-income communities certainly have a unique vulnerability because they don't necessarily have the resources to have cooling infrastructure in homes or be able to necessarily afford, you know, the energy bills to keep an air conditioner running for a long time, and may not have access to quality health care to be able to protect themselves in the event of a heat illness.
And so one important thing that we can derive from this is that there is hope as long as we start taking some action now.
Yes, there is a lot of reason for hope. What our study really demonstrates is the amount of power that we have in the decisions that we make today. We can really craft a future and shape a future in which our children can have the tools and ability to stay safe. Or we can, you know, make decisions to stay in a pathway that we're currently on that increases the risk for our children. And actually, in fact, not even just our children, but ourselves. We have results that show that significant changes could happen by mid-century. And we have the power to shape things by what we decide to do now. So I think there is a lot of hope in that. And I hope it'll really catalyze people and encourage people to demand change.
Dr. Licker, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's climate scientist Rachel Licker with the Union of Concerned Scientists, and she spoke with our Daisy Contreras. A reminder, our podcast is available each week through NPR One. You can find all of our episodes through our website at statewideshow.com. Our email address is there, too. You can drop us a line. Let us know you're tuned in. Next, economic hardship that has hit many rural Illinois communities has not been bad for everyone. Eric Stock with member station WGLT explains.
Dollar stores are growing in number, often in smaller towns which simply lack the means to sustain more family-owned grocers. That's according to Chris Merritt, director of the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University.
If you look at small towns that have in fact seen their grocery store, their family-owned grocery store go out of business, as a result of a Dollar General coming in, then I think the argument would be that they're in fact making it worse.
Merritt says dollar stores might have lower prices and longer hours than the mom-and-pop stores, but they typically have fewer employees and their profits don't stay in the community. I'm Eric Stock.
A group of gun dealers is suing the state of Illinois, trying to block new regulations on their businesses. The gun shops say a new law requiring they have state licenses on top of already having federal licenses will put a lot of them out of business. Eight dealers and the State Rifle Association are pushing back on the new requirements for state certification. Their attorney, David Siegel, says the regulations are driven by a fear mentality.
That the dealers in the state are somehow complicit with gangbangers in Chicago and those who would create havoc somewhere.
But Democratic State Senator Don Harmon from Oak Park sponsored the law and says he expects it will be upheld in court.
I've read the complaint. I haven't studied it. It seems like pretty weak soup to me. I don't know how it impairs anybody's Second Amendment rights. You can still buy a gun.
He says he expects most Illinois gun dealers already have surveillance systems that meet the law's requirements and will have no trouble complying. The gun dealers say the law's requirements are too expensive. For retail locations, that includes a $1,500 annual fee, surveillance cameras, and electronic records of all guns. Want to hear a piece of history? That's a more than century-old pipe organ purchased with help from the Carnegie Foundation. And
Andrew Carnegie is remembered for his philanthropy. The industrialist wound up giving away an estimated 90% of his fortune to causes like libraries and education. But less known was how he helped many churches and community centers obtain pipe organs. The foundation called the organ matching gifts benefactions. More than 8,000 were manufactured and distributed around the world, including 207 here in Illinois. But that was a long time ago, and tracking down those organs, if they still exist, requires some detective work. Paula Romano is a concert organist, teacher, and early music scholar. She joined me to talk about the effort.
This was a benefaction that was not widely known, and this came after the time when he gave the money for the libraries. And libraries went really all over the world. But the organs did too, but there were not as many as we have, you know, throughout the United States. In Illinois, though, Illinois was the third largest number of organs that the foundation helped to provide the money for. And there are 207 in our state.
But, of course, not all of those are still operating.
I've unfortunately found some stories of where the organs were just dismantled because the church had no longer been viable or they couldn't raise money to keep it tuned, things like that. Occasionally you find that they might end up in somebody's basement or taking a ceiling out of a room and putting an organ in there. But sometimes they were given away. They were given to other churches to use. One such place was an organ that was in a house already, and the people didn't know what to do with this house, but they gave it to a university in Michigan, and all of a sudden it became one of the practice rooms or one of the small recital halls. There is in Virginia, Illinois, in a town of 1700, there is one, it's a Hook and Hastings organ, and what's so unique about it, the only thing that has been done in this 130 years has been that they just put an electric blower on it. And that one, when my father was a little boy, he used to pump that. That was his way to give his service to the church. And so he would hand pump it, a little wind machine, and you had to keep it pumping or to keep the air in it. But he had to also do it when the organist was going to practice. I think he was looking forward to getting a little bit older, so he didn't have to go do that. But I've been able to identify almost 90 of the 207 organs, which all came from one builder called Hook and Hastings, which is out of Vermont. And then there is another company, which is out of the Peak and Peoria area, and it's Hinner's. They were quite prolific in their instruments that they put in around our area. And it was not a name of an organ builder that I knew that well, but another forgotten thing for Illinois.
Do you know why Carnegie was so interested in giving organs? The library thing makes some sense to people, mm-hmm. but maybe the organs, was there some personal connection there?
He sort of had an Anabaptist. He was a Swedenborg, but enlightened thought, not much doctrine. But he gave a church to the church where his family had attended. And before he knew it, there was a Catholic church that heard about what he had done for his home church, and on it went.
Do we know how many of the 200-plus that were given in Illinois are still in use, though? Do we have a pretty good number on that?
Well, that's where I'm a sleuth right now. I've been sleuthing for a couple of years. And we have 97 Hook and Hastings, and I've been able to find out what churches they are. Part of it, not all of these instruments went into wealthy churches. So wealthy churches could afford to change everything around and say, I want to get a blank and blank electric organ, and so they might have been taken out. These instruments, I think, that have stood the test of time.
I would imagine through the decades, fewer and fewer people know how to play these instruments.
Not true, because it's been the other way around. You think that it is diminishing. To be an organist, is you have to be an entrepreneur yourself, and you have to spend a lot of years going to school. And it really, what we do as organists, it isn't matched. What we have isn't matched with our what you're given as money. But I don't think any of us can really do anything else. But I like this instrument at the Christian Church in Virginia, Illinois. I had played there. I practiced there when I was a young girl. And they were really sweet. They let me get a key, and my father used to sit with me and be there, so I wasn't alone in the church. But that's happened all over. In this little town of Virginia, Illinois, they have had about 12 organists from, say, 1920 through now that have come out of this little town of 1700. I think with the interest in historic instruments, we're seeing that churches are going to be able to perhaps get their instrument restored. It's sort of hand in hand. A lot of organists didn't stay with playing the instrument, giving up their Sundays for something they weren't going to get a lot of money for, or the church didn't take care of their instruments, was falling down. But we're finding that changing. Over the last maybe 15 years, there have been colleges that have ramped up their teaching of instruments. We're finding new organs going all over the place. So it is an exciting time. But one of the things that I'm hoping that we can do out of this project is to find organ builders that are really interested in these early organs of the 1900s and being able to hopefully get through Carnegie to see if they can help with a fund that we can also make another grant request to help these people in the churches that don't know where to go. Sometimes it's way beyond tuning, that we can have them sing again.
Paula Romano talking with us about pipe organs Andrew Carnegie helped make possible for many churches and local centers. She says there were more than 200 in Illinois. She's working to find out how many still exist. You can learn more at our website at statewideshow.com. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, at one time, Kaskaskia in southwest Illinois was a prosperous community. It was even the first state capital. Then a string of bad luck left it nearly a ghost town today. We'll find out more about the history of Kaskaskia that's still to come on Statewide. Several years ago, Illinois overhauled how it taught civics to high schoolers. A new measure would add the same requirement for middle school students. Peter Medlin has more.
Jim Vera teaches government at Oswego East High School. He often has his students, mostly sophomores, stand in all four corners of the classroom. The corners are marked agree, disagree, strongly agree, and strongly disagree. He starts small. Do we have a good sports program here? They all pick a corner. Then the debate escalates until eventually they're discussing topics like, is it okay to burn the American flag? This is one of the four mandatory components of the civics class. The others are government institutions, service learning, and simulations. The flag-burning conversation is part of the current and controversial issues, which I'm sure you could have guessed.
Like, I always tell our younger teachers that, you know, if you see something's going bad, don't be afraid of it, but, like, give a kid a voice, but, like, don't be afraid to challenge the kid. Okay, well, where is your information on that from?
Vera acknowledges that these conversations can be hard. For students, yes, but also their teachers, who don't want to be called into the principal's office because of a complaint from a parent that their kid is talking about burning flags in class. That's happened to Vera in the past, too.
Doing an activity like the Four Corners kind of allows a kid, that quiet kid that maybe has strong feeling on something, but doesn't necessarily want to speak out on it. At least in that way, they feel like they still have a voice.
Members of the first class affected by the 2015 high school measure are going to be seniors this year. And since many schools offer civics as a senior course, a lot of students across the state will be taking it for the first time soon. And that's just in time for all of them to turn 18 before the presidential election next year. Vera says for both high school and middle school civics, it's smart to keep things as local as possible, especially for those service learning projects. Vera's students have talked to village and school board members about installing lights at intersections and changing backpack rules at their own school.
I think the most important part of those projects is like the research and finding out who to go to. You know, you don't write a letter to the president when you want to get a stoplight put in.
After the high school civics mandate passed, regional mentor teachers, including Vera, went to Springfield for training with the News Literacy Project.
Information is the most basic ingredient of civics.
That's Peter Adams. He's the Senior Vice President of Education at the News Literacy Project, and he also is the one that helped train those teachers.
You know, it's daunting. I mean, we're all sort of grappling with the largest and most complex information landscape in human history, and that's incredibly daunting for the young people who are inheriting that landscape, but it's also daunting for educators who are trying to teach them about it.
For the project, it's not just about high school and middle school kids being able to identify what is and is not a credible source, although that is important, especially on social media. Adam says it's also about understanding why a post is in your feed at all.
Even though, you know, they may not have smartphones at those younger grades, by middle school, they certainly do.
John Silva is a news literacy and civics team leader for the project. He also taught civics for over a decade at Chicago Public Schools.
And it's at that age where they are much more curious about the world, but they're also at a developmental age where they're not able to quite so easily recognize when they're being manipulated by misinformation or propaganda or conspiracy theories.
So Adam says the organization wants to help students unlock the architecture of these social platforms to see if they can see who's behind a questionable post and if they can report them.
So for example, on Pinterest, you can report posts or pins as medical misinformation, which is a very specific, but I think very important possibility there, that there's a label for that.
Silva says once young students have the tools to maneuver the social media information minefield, then they can move forward into civil discourse. Jim Vera over at Oswego East agrees it's important to build confidence for kids as young as middle school in those arenas.
In a lot of ways, the younger kids are able to like handle those concepts better than things like memorizing the chain of command for the executive branch.
If signed by the governor, the plan for middle school civics would go into effect in the 2020-21 school year. I'm Peter Medlin.
Large barns that dot the landscape across much of the central U.S. typically house hogs or chickens, and those animals eat a lot of soybeans on their way to becoming our dinner. Someday, that soy protein could be fattening up more Midwestern seafood. Amy Mayer has the story.
In this huge greenhouse in central Iowa, blowers move air and water as tilapia swim in tanks. Joe Sweeney is CEO of the fish farm Eagle's Catch. He sells live tilapia to markets in places like New York and Chicago. The farm starts with tiny, nearly translucent tilapia. But they grow fast and efficiently convert their feed into human food.
And when you compare them to other livestock, they're actually getting more protein per pound of feed input than any other animal class.
The fish are hand-fed five times a day, and the tilapia grow from minuscule to 2 pounds in about 9 months. Their high-protein diet relies on soybeans, so you might think that's why Sweeney built his business in an area surrounded by soybean fields. But Sweeney says the commercial fish food he buys comes from the South.
Unfortunately, feeding Louisiana and Arkansas soybeans, but I think as time goes on, I really look forward to being able to feed them that Iowa product.
Globally, aquaculture has huge potential to help meet the needs of a growing population that's eating more protein. But to achieve that, plant proteins will have to take on a greater role. That's because governments restrict harvesting wild fish to feed farmed fish. Iowa State University professor Kurt Rosenstrater has been developing soybean-based fish food.
In Iowa, in particular, we can play a huge role globally in terms of providing protein ingredients for the aquaculture industry.
Rosenstrater has worked with aquaculture projects in Asia, where countries import a lot of U.S. soybeans. More recently, corn protein, a byproduct of ethanol production, is also showing promise.
Many of the biorefineries are taking the next step to produce a more concentrated form of corn protein. And this is one of those things that's really going to be taking the industry by storm the next couple of years.
Across 12 states in the north-central part of the U.S., from Ohio to North Dakota to Kansas, hundreds of businesses are trying to grow fish for food. But local demand will have to grow to make them viable.
Diets, in many respects, are cultural-based. And so we are, in the Midwest, eating more fish than we used to eat. but still not as much as other parts of the world.
But even here, frozen seafood, often imported, certainly sells. 5 years ago, Julie Taglin and her husband decided to challenge that market. The Forest City, Iowa couple opened an indoor saltwater shrimp farm.
They're Pacific white shrimp. We get them as babies. They're the size of an eyelash.
J&J Dry Dock Shrimp is a direct-to-consumer business that's part of a local foods network.
The majority of our customers, including myself, have never had fresh seafood.
But Taglin says she has a waiting list of customers for the 140 pounds or so of shrimp she harvests every few months. Her shrimp feed comes from a Pennsylvania company that tells her they're working to replace fish meal with more soy protein. And it's not just soy protein. Purdue University fisheries professor Paul Brown says at this point, researchers are looking at what other plant proteins could replace soy.
My goodness, it's lupins, it's pea proteins, it's any potential commodity that can be further processed and into a high-protein ingredient.
Will fish barns or greenhouses someday become another prominent feature of the Midwest landscape? These folks all say maybe, but not immediately. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Historians David McDonald and Rain Waters have taken a fresh look at the story of Illinois' first capital city in a new book called Kaskaskia, The Lost Capital of Illinois. They've put together what they say is a comprehensive account of the town, complete with historical photos, maps, even tales of a centuries-old curse. Our reporter Sam Dunklaw sat down with the authors to talk about the history and the hard knocks of Kaskaskia, a town that went from being a bustling territorial hub to an almost forgotten hamlet of merely a dozen people.
David, this town of Kaskaskia, for our listeners who maybe have never been there, can't really place it on a map, where is it, and in your opinions, why is this little town so important to Illinois history?
Well, it's about 65 miles south of St. Louis, but of course on the Illinois side of the river. It was founded when some Jesuits and the Kaskaskia Indians settled there in 1703. From that time until about 1830, it was the largest settlement anywhere around. It was the largest of the French villages. It was our territorial capital. It was our first state capital. And then after 1820, it began to decline. And eventually it was swept away by the Mississippi and now doesn't exist at all. Although there is a town called Kaskaskia, but that's New Kaskaskia, 3 miles away from the site of Old Kaskaskia.
Why did they choose to settle there? And why was it valuable to those that did?
Well, it was very, very rich bottom soil, wonderful for grazing animals, wonderful for raising crops, but it also had problems. It floods quite regularly and sometimes disastrously.
And that is sort of where things start to come apart. The book also mentions the town suffered from inept rule from both the British when they took over and then the Americans when they took over from the British. Can you give any examples of that and whether or not it contributed to sort of the beginning of the end for Kaskaskia?
Well, between 1765, when the British moved in, and 1778, when George Rogers Clark conquered the area for the new American Republic, the British had 9 different governors, all military men, none skilled in civil administration, several of them notably corrupt, others perhaps well-meaning, but totally inept. And then George Rogers Clark came in, and he was fairly well greeted by the French. And then when they pulled out in the early 1780s, they didn't leave much of anything behind, and there was virtual anarchy for some years. So that left a period from 1765 to 1790 that discouraged many people, and even under the American rule, many left.
And during this time, there's a lot of things going on. What are the sort of things that Kaskaskia had to contend with?
Well, a tornado ripped through in, I think it was 1812. The New Madrid earthquakes hit Kaskaskia very hard. There were 4 or 5 years of successive crop failures in the 1880s. And remember, these people are not only growing for the market, they're growing subsistence food. So there was hunger in the land during those years.
The town is eventually swallowed whole by the Mississippi. Can you describe that?
the banks of the Mississippi had been largely denuded of trees in order mm-hmm. to feed the boilers, the sidewheel steamers. So the river grew wider, shallower, and began to erode away the banks. And then finally it began to change course and ate into the narrow neck of land between Kaskaskia, one side, was limestone bluffs. They were not about to be eroded away. And the other side on which Kaskaskia stood was soft alluvial soil. So the town succumbed and nothing could be done to save it.
Rain, I want to turn to your work on the curse of the town. The both of you write in the book that it is certainly interesting coincidence that the number of misfortunes befall this town to where, quote, even a reasonable person could be forgiven for thinking that the town was cursed.
Exactly. That's what fascinated me about it. It's superstitious, I guess, but we all have our little superstitions, and it's very easy to believe in those things, you know, and the town maybe in a sense it was cursed.
How did that begin, and can you differentiate for us the facts of sort of what led people to believe that versus the fiction that was created?
When things were going wrong in the 1780s, a local priest wrote something of a lament about the sad state of the town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And later on, a portion of that lament, just a line or two, was taken by some people as a curse rather than a complaint.
Yeah. Well, you have to think about the location of Kaskaskia. You've got tornadoes, floods, famine, disease. It was not the greatest of location in spite of the soil being so wonderful. There was just a lot happened there. And so his complaints were kind of valid.
The curse, as it is told in 1892 and in 1902, are complete fictions loaded with all sorts of anachronisms. For instance, sometime before 1712, an Indian and French couple are supposedly fleeing to St. Louis, which wasn't founded until 1764.
I think they attempted to take off, and
yeah,
the young man was taken by the father
and
put on that boat, we'll call it a raft, and set off on the Mississippi, and for dead. Just sent him off. And as he's floating away, he curses the town. I'm laughing. It's not funny, but it is funny. I mean, you know, because that's the part that's another part that's made up.
And there are many other historical blunders in these stories that show that they are fiction.
They kind of took the curse and romanced it up a bit.
Quite a bit.
As we went on into the early part of the 19th century, Kaskaskia becomes the territorial capital and then the state capital for Illinois. But then it loses its place as the state capital to Vandalia. What happened there?
Well, there were a number of talking points about why they wanted to move the capital. They said, oh, Kaskaskia floods too regularly and they have to use rented buildings there. But the real reason was that a number of the state legislators had bought land around Vandalia cheaply and expected to make a killing when the capital moved there and people moved following the capital. I'm kind of pleased to say that Vandalia never really took off all that much and they didn't make the killing they had hoped. But it was sort of a corrupt political deal that led to the movement.
It was probably only convenient that Kaskaskia did in fact flood as much as it did.
Well, it was the beginning of a long tradition of Illinois politics.
What are you two most proud about having finished this three-year-long work?
Well, I think gathering the photos and trying to bring together a connected narrative from so many different sources.
You know, I grew up in a military family. I've lived all over the U.S. I was born in North Carolina and lived there mostly. But I guess I'm from Illinois now, and this is some history, part of my history to me. This is important.
That's reporter Sam Dunklaw talking with historians David McDonald and Rain Waters about their new book, Kaskaskia, The Lost Capital of Illinois. Find a link to our interview and a summary of the book. It's at our website at statewideshow.com. Coming up next, with the 50th anniversary of the moon landing upon us, we learn about the man who knew the way to the moon. Stick around for more of Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We're glad you're with us. Be sure to tune in for the show at this time each week. Well, Saturday, July 20th marks 50 years since the first man landed on the moon. That momentous day in 1969 made astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin household names. But years before that, a lesser-known figure, John Hobolt, was on a mission to make that first moon landing a success. John Hobolt was a native of Illinois, an airplane engineer who believed he knew the way to the moon. A new audiobook tells the story of how he risked his career to break rinks and convince his colleagues and NASA officials he was right. Christine Herman spoke with Todd Zwillich. He is a frequent contributor to NPR and WAMU's 1A. He's also a former host and correspondent of The Takeaway. And he's the author of the Audible original, The Man Who Knew the Way to the Moon.
So you describe John Hobolt as an unsung hero in the first moon landing. Can you take us back to the early 1960s and explain how he came to play a critical role in Apollo 11?
Yeah, and to tell this story, you really do have to go back to the early days. And at that time, in the back rooms of NASA, engineers are already theorizing and arguing and debating about how they might go to the moon one day. There was no national program to go to the moon. They were still trying to get Mercury off the ground, literally, you know, trying to race the Russians to get Alan Shepard into space. That wouldn't happen for another year and a half or so. But in the back rooms, they know that probably the moon is going to be a target at some point. Seems logical. And there are lots of debates flying around about how they're going to go. And a lot of the early ideas about how to get to the moon are pretty remarkable because, you know, they'll remind you of some of the old movies or comics or books from the 20s or the 1910s or the turn of the century that you might have seen about one day going to the moon. I mean, the main mode of preference at NASA at this time was to launch a giant rocket from the Earth, big enough that you'd stage off pieces of it, it would get to the moon and back that rocket down butt first onto the moon for a landing. I mean, really kind of almost ancient stuff when you think about it. So one of the main ideas was to do this. John Hobolt got involved in this debate sort of from the side. You know, he was an outsider in this sense. He did work at NASA, but he wasn't an aerospace engineer. No, he was an aeronautical engineer. He was an airplane guy. And he was around the debates. He contributed to a lot of the early data on orbits. You know, we were starting to send satellites up. We knew we were going to try to send humans up, and we needed to understand how objects orbit the Earth. How do you get them in for reentry? John did the calculations on those things, and so he sort of got a foot in the door on these early debates about the moon, even though he wasn't really part of the hierarchy that was making it happen. John Hobolt's in these back rooms saying no. You can't land a big rocket backward on the moon. Number one, it's just dangerous. That rocket has to be 90, 100 feet tall. It has to be filled with fuel because you need that fuel to get out of the moon's gravity and back home. It could literally tip over. It's not a safe way to do it. But more important in John's eyes, his arguments were the size of the boosters and the size of that rocket to take all that mass to the moon. Just inefficient. How are we ever going to build a rocket that big?
So what was the idea that John Hobolt had?
So John's idea was something different. John said lunar orbit rendezvous. And what lunar orbit rendezvous says is don't take all of that fuel, don't take all of that weight down to the moon's surface so that you have to launch it all back home. Why not leave most of it in orbit? Leave it up there. You don't have to spend all that fuel to take it down to the moon's surface, take a very lightweight craft down to the moon, a maneuverable craft, not a big unwieldy rocket, but a tiny little lander that the astronauts can steer and can see the surface to land. That's the way you do it. And the easiest way to understand this for regular people, I think, is think of a big ocean ship, you know, exploring a couple hundred years ago. You're going to the New World, if you like, in a big ship. And then you want to go back home. Well, you should get across the ocean in that big ship and carry all your crew and your equipment. But when you get to the shore, you shouldn't drive that big ship right up against the shore. You're going to hit rocks. You're going to hit waves. You're going to wreck your ship. Why not get into a rowboat, a dinghy, and just take the dinghy ashore? And when you're done on the shore, get in your dinghy and go back to the ship. It's really a similar concept. John said, take a small lander down. When you're done exploring, launch back up from the moon, rendezvous, lunar orbit rendezvous in orbit with a mothership around the moon, then go home. Save all that weight, save all that mass. That was his argument.
Yeah, so this concept of lunar orbit rendezvous, it wasn't one that he invented, but you write about how he was the one who started to apply it to the technologies that were within NASA's grasp at the time. And how was he treated by his colleagues and NASA leaders at the time?
Well, this is one of the most remarkable parts of the story, because when John started campaigning and campaigning hard for this idea, he was grabbing anyone he could. He was grabbing fellow engineers in the hallway. He was grabbing bosses. If they came down to Langley to tour the place, he would grab them on the side and try to lobby them on lunar orbit rendezvous. And he was going to every meeting that he could. There were tons and tons of committees at this time. This committee, this task group, this group is meeting panels all the time to talk, debate about modes to go to the moon, to vote on those ideas. And John is really trying to wiggle his way into all of these that he can. Now, you asked how he was treated, and this is really one of the most confusing and remarkable parts of the story, because a lot of times John was treated with polite indifference. A lot of times he got the brush off. And at other times, he was downright abused. And I'll give you one example that really stands out, and there are a number of them in the story that I think just will give people pause. In December of 1960, so very early, we're talking 6 months before Jack Kennedy challenges the country to go to the moon, John is at a high-level meeting of NASA leaders. All the big shots are there, and they're engineers. They're just debating ideas for maybe thinking about a moon mission. Again, the challenge has not been made by the White House. This is just them discussing the issue. And some engineers get up and they talk about this mode of direct ascent, launching the big rocket and landing butt first on the moon. They talk about another method, which is assembling a spacecraft in orbit, then sending that rocket to the moon. That's called Earth Orbit Rendezvous, another contender in the debates. John gets up to talk about rendezvous, which he had some expertise in, and then he throws in a pitch for lunar orbit rendezvous. We should rendezvous around the moon. We should use a small, lightweight craft, a lunar lander. And he gives his talk, and all of a sudden, another engineer, a very well-known engineer, a guy named Max Faget, he was a renowned engineer, a brilliant man. He designed the Mercury capsule that took John Glenn into space. He later would go on to help design the space shuttle. So he was a heavy hitter engineer. Max Faget hears John's presentation on lunar orbit rendezvous and shoots out of his seat. He stands up and he pounds the table in front of everyone. And he says, "Don't listen to Hobolt. His figures lie." He accused John of being a liar in front of everyone, in front of all of his colleagues. This was a humiliating, embarrassing experience for John. One that I can tell you, you'll hear in the story, he never forgot. Not for the rest of his life, he carried these scars. There are other incidents as well that you will hear in the story, but the answer is John faced a mixture of indifference, at times abuse, and at times ridicule that he never forgot, until things started to change and engineers started to realize his data might be right.
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned John Hobolt is a native of Illinois, and you came here for part of your research and reporting process for this book. Where did you go and who did you talk to?
Oh, that was a great trip. Well, I started in Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois, John's proud alma mater, for his undergraduate engineering degree. John's papers are housed in the historical archives at University of Illinois. So I came there for a couple of days, worked with the archival staff there who are just wonderful, dug into 60 boxes of John's records. And I'll tell you, it was eye-opening. and it was special. John was a meticulous individual, and the amount of material that he kept, of course, his academic papers, his engineering papers, his sketches, his drawings, but correspondence, professional, personal, personal receipts, notes, travel vouchers, arguments with other people, letters that he scrawled to other characters in this story when they were having disagreements, but he never mailed them. It appeared that he was just blowing off steam, keeping inventory of his decision along with his wife, Mary, about whether or not they should move to New Jersey at one point. I mean, the wow. man kept it all. It's all housed there at the University of Illinois. So I was there. I went to Joliet, which is John's hometown, where he grew up, the son of servants. His father was a caretaker. His mother was a cook for a wealthy local senator in Joliet. They spent their lives in the servants' quarters on Senator Barr's estate in Joliet, Illinois. I visited that town. I visited John's relatives who still live in the area, some of them in Joliet, some of them in Ransom, Illinois, population 400, about 20 minutes outside of Joliet, to really get the sense of the place. His nephews were wonderful to me. And a little bit of time in Chicago as well on that trip, but a trip to Illinois to really try to get the sense of where John came from. You know, he put himself through junior college at Joliet Junior College. He was very proud of it. He put himself through University of Illinois. He got a grant and a scholarship for undergrad and for his PhD. This was a young man who was born onto a farm, and he absolutely hated it. His parents had nothing when he was a little boy. His parents were immigrants from Holland, came over. His father came over when he was just 16 to try to find a new life. He was a tenant farmer. John was one of these people you hear about who was very unhappy with his station in life as a young boy, and he was determined to get out of it. And he got himself out of it. He realized that he had engineering and mathematical capability, and Joliet Junior College, University of Illinois, he put it to use. He got out of there and got himself to NASA.
You know, as you look back at what was happening in the 1960s and what's happening today in terms of renewed efforts to get back to the moon and ultimately to Mars, what are some of the similarities you see?
Oh, I think it's remarkable. You know, NASA has changed an awful lot. This is a story in John's day, let's be honest, of a whole lot of old dead dudes. Old dead guys, you know, and that's fine. That's the way NASA was at the time. John's wife, Mary, is a big part of this story as well. I do want to tell you that she has a fascinating story. Mary was a human computer at NASA Langley in the 40s, just like the Hidden Figures of the book and the movie. Not just like, she's not African-American, not a hidden figure in that sense, but she was in the same operation a number of years before. So same job, and she has a fascinating story. You ask about today, and NASA has really made a big effort to change the face of people outwardly facing, to sell the public on its missions, and to hire a lot more women and a lot more minorities into the STEM fields. And so they're doing that. Some of them are in this story as well. That's only a small part of it. On the technical side, the debates that John went through, how do we go to the moon? How do we manage the fuel that we'll need and the mass that we'll need? How do we actually land and actually come back? Well, in John's day, the idea of doing a rendezvous around the moon at first was unheard of. They had never tried rendezvous when he was trying to sell them on this issue. They had never tried it around the Earth. Here comes John Hobolt to say, let's try it around the moon, 250,000 miles away. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason why people were terrified of him and of his data at first. Today, we know that that can work because we've done it, of course, and the administration says we're heading back to the moon. The debates over how exactly we do that are starting all over again. And in some cases, they're very similar to those in John's day because physics doesn't change. Everything else does, but physics doesn't change. How do we get the mass that we'll need for some of the bigger things? We want habitats. We want vehicles. Will we want refueling capability on the moon? We're going to have to manage all of that mass. How much of it do we park in orbit, and how much of it do we send directly to the moon? When you talk about Mars, gosh, 150 million miles on average, a whole orders of magnitude of a bigger problem. Do we do some form of Martian orbit rendezvous? Do we send a station, build a station in Martian orbit that we can stage down to the surface to manage all that mass, prevent you having to go directly to the Martian surface, try to slow down in that thin Martian atmosphere, and then launch to come back home. A lot of problems to think about. And because the physics hasn't changed, the basics of the debates that John went through 60 years ago in the hallways of NASA are really starting all over again.
Todd Zwillich is author of The Man Who Knew the Way to the Moon. He spoke with Christine Herman. The Audible original focuses on Illinois native John Hobolt, an airplane engineer who played a key role in the space race and the eventual moon landing. That wraps up another Statewide. If you missed any of our episode, you can find this one and the others at statewideshow.com. Also, our podcasts can be located through the NPR One app. Be with us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations. Thank you.